One of the most deeply embedded concepts we hold about nature is that nature is in balance, that the natural state is one of equilibrium. Along comes a theory that says, no, the natural state of nature is one of disruption. In fact, as one person has put it, the natural state of nature is a state of permanent uproar. I'm Susan McGinnis for Conversations. On this edition of Conversations, the spotted owl, logging, and learning to mimic nature's naturally disruptive state. I hope you'll join us. Our guest today is silviculturalist and forestry ecologist, Dr. Chadwick Oliver. Chad, thanks very much for taking time to join us today.
I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad. It seems to me that one of the better ways to approach a new way of thinking is to go back and take a look at what we have thought. Why is it, or how is it, that we've come to believe, in whatever thumbnail sketch you can give us, that nature's natural state is equilibrium, balance?
I think it has to do with several things. One is a philosophical perspective that goes back to the days of Rousseau and others, that people started thinking that somehow the natural condition, the primitive human left to itself, was some type of a benign system. If you remember, Rousseau had this back-to-nature philosophy that had such things as Marie Antoinette putting a milk shed behind her Versailles palace so she could go play the simple milkmaid. But it's partly this philosophical idea that back to nature gives us a certain stability. The second reason, I think, is that processes and patterns in nature occur over fairly long times, or within the span of the human memory, at fairly infrequent intervals. For example, a very large fire may occur only once every three generations in a given area, and that has a tremendous impact on the forest. But since that fire may only occur 1 week in three generations, people tend to forget about it. So they tend to look at nature as a stable condition. This was especially true before our present mass communication and transportation ability. I can give you a good example of this. In 1938, the largest hurricane to hit New England occurred. It blew down somewhere over 250,000 acres of forest. Now, I have two friends. One was in Rhode Island, in Providence, and the other one was in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Both of them said that they were adults during the storm. The storm went through. They had no pre-warning of it. And afterwards, for several days, they thought it was just a local windstorm that hit just their community. Now, that was 1938, only about 50 years ago. On the other hand, if you look at our modern communication right now, the whole world knew about the coming of Hurricane Hugo, about the fires around Sydney, Australia, the Yellowstone fire.
Oh, Andrew and Iniki also come to mind.
Exactly. So we're now more aware of the large scale of these disturbances and that they seem to hit everywhere in the world. So it's interesting that our education has allowed us to think in longer time spans and broader geographic spans.
Now, I want to check my notion against your knowledge. It seems to me that we're looking at these natural disasters that you say have been occurring regularly as new, and therefore that we're out of control, that there's a greater problem.
Right.
Oh, this is very interesting. That's maybe not so.
No, it's not. They've always occurred. They always will occur. It's just that we're now getting more aware of them. And I'm not a psychologist, but there may have also been a psychological strength in ignoring such things, because if looked at from an idea of needing some type of stability, it puts people in a relatively unstable condition.
This is Dr. Chadwick Oliver. He's our guest today on Conversations. Your area is silviculture, is working with forests to make them a better, more biodiverse environment. So let's take a look at what you know about forests relative to nature being in a constant state of disruption. What does that mean to you? What's this new information we have about forests?
Well, what we used to think, of course, is that the forest that we saw in any given place was a group of trees that had permanently been in a single area and that somehow co-evolved with each other so that they were in some type of a condition that they were interdependent on each other and that they had always remained in the condition that we see them. Now, what we are realizing instead is that what we see in a forest is almost a snapshot in time. Now, you have to keep in mind that I don't want to be alarmist on this to the extent that we need to worry about everything being forever in turmoil, because some of these disturbances and changes occurred over decades or longer period of time. So what we now realize is that the forest that we see is a group of species that happen to be living together at this time because they happen, in the course of the different species migrating, happen to migrate into the same area. In the future, they may migrate to other places so that they it would be a different forest, different community in the future. They're also existing in the position and structure because of some past history of a certain type of disturbance that allowed these particular species to have the advantage and grow together.
Can you be specific? Can you take a kind of tree or an animal and show how it might be attracted to one area at one time but not to it at another?
I would rather give you examples from the Pacific Northwest, but I could then I'll try to give you some similar examples from Alaska.
That's fine. Let me take this opportunity to say that the desire to give examples for the Pacific Northwest is because Dr. Chad Oliver is a professor of silviculture and forest ecology at the University of Washington in Seattle. Most of his experience has been in the Pacific Northwest. Thanks.
Okay. To give you an example, the forest that we see, for example, around Mount St. Helens in Washington, was a very old forest with certain species there, Douglas firs, hemlocks, Pacific silver firs, and others. Some of the trees were 4, 5, 6 feet in diameter. So it looked like a very stable forest. Now, people had given a certain permanence to this type of forest in many places. In 1980, I believe it was, or shortly thereafter, the volcano erupted and in 9 minutes blew down about 90,000 acres of this forest. Well, what you get after this disturbance is very similar to what we get after disturbances such as fires, windstorms, floods. You suddenly get an open area with a lot of small vegetation, herbs, shrubs, flowering species. Now, believe it or not, that has an awful lot of species in it and a lot of diversity. Mm. Now, in many places in the world, after a while, the trees begin to grow up and close off that area of forest. Once that area of forest becomes closed, the species that needed those openings, that lived in them, could no longer live there. And if there weren't disturbances occurring elsewhere, then the species that live there become extirpated or possibly extinct. Mm-hmm. We've had forest species become extinct when we had the forest close up and exclude this open condition. Now, the forest that regrows may not be the same species that was there before the disturbance.
And why is that so?
Several reasons. One is the species that dominates an area often for several hundred years or even up to 1,000 years or more is a species that is able to have a competitive advantage at the time it becomes established. And there are a couple of things that dictate what species has a competitive advantage. One is some types of disturbances give some species an advantage. Others give other species an advantage. Another thing is our climate has constantly been fluctuating. It's about the year 1000 up to around 1200, the climate was very warm. Then we went into a cool period from about 1300 up through 1850 or 1900. Now we're coming into a warmer period. So the trees that got established that are now about 800 years old on a given area got established in a warm climate. Mm-hmm. If you had a disturbance to part of the area 400 years ago, you would have species that are more adapted to cool areas there. And now if we have another disturbance, we'll get species adapted to a warm area.
The emerging notion, as I'm listening to you, is that we've been managing forests and other landforms to keep things the same. When you say the natural instinct of the forest and other land areas is to adjust and shift as it rains or the drought comes or the hurricane or whatever.
Exactly.
So have we been doing quite the wrong thing with the best of intentions?
Well, you have to realize that the humans have been just another of these disturbance factors. And
oh, this is the humans are not God theory, isn't it? Yes.
I never heard it put like that. But we have been impacting the forests in different ways. Mm-hmm. And we have, historically, the human impact has been quite widespread. But we're now becoming aware that we are impacting it in certain ways. Mm-hmm. And our impact on it has been in many ways mimicking disturbances. There are some things that people are concerned about, and one is, for example, that when you had a natural disturbance, you may have several hundred to a thousand to hundreds of thousands of acres destroyed, but there would be another area that wasn't destroyed. Mm-hmm. And just as I said, you have some species that need these open areas. Some species are dependent on the very old forests. And if you have disturbances that create a disturbance in one area, you protect the open species, but then the species that need the closed forest go to another area. If we do something like either protect the forest so that we don't have any open areas occurring, then we threaten the species that use the open areas. If, on the other hand, we cut down all the forests for one reason or another so that we don't have any closed forests, we threaten the species that go there. So very often what we have been doing is we have changed the extent or the timing of these disturbances, that we have lost one of the other patterns that basically the different species utilize.
And this has been kind of a feast or famine management. We clear cut or we protect the old growth.
I'd have to think about that. In terms of feast or famine, I suppose in places you could say that.
Okay.
We've had just, if you look around the world, we've had such a variety of different activities. By doing such things as deciding we're not going to clear cut, we have threatened certain species, but we've protected others. Mm-hmm. In deciding we're not going to allow natural fires to burn, we've protected certain species, but threatened others. So that deciding, trying to make a single policy of this is the way we'll behave, we've threatened some species and not others.
Okay. Chad Oliver is our guest on Conversations, a bit of background. His education has been in these ways, a Bachelor of Science in Forestry in 1968 from the University of the South in Sewanee, is that the pronunciation?
Right.
In Sewanee, Tennessee. His Master of Forest Service came from Yale School of Forestry. Another master's degree from the Yale Graduate School, also the Department of Forestry, with a major emphasis on silviculture, and his doctorate from the Department of Forestry and Environmental Studies in 1975, also from Yale. Dr. Chad Oliver is our guest on Conversations. As you've been talking, I have been wondering about what we think of as the destruction of rainforests, deforestation of areas of the Himalayas, other places around the world, both natural and at the hand of human beings. What's your quick read on deforestation? Is it not permanent then?
It doesn't have to be permanent, in that there, if we start looking back at history, there are many places that historically we thought we're always in a perpetual state of old growth and that human deforestation has created a problem. We look back and at past times there was also a significant amount of deforestation and then a regrowth of forests as populations have ebbed and flowed. So that there are, of course, real concerns. If we had an area where we deforested it and there are no older forests for the different forest-grown species to live, then we've lost that species, and our present society doesn't want to do that. Mm-hmm. So it's the what I'm concerned about is that deforestation isn't put in such a broad scale that it threatens certain species. You also have to realize that human well-being is partly related to how they manage the forest, but what commodities they extract from the forest. And on the other hand, the well-being, the amount of diversity you have in a forest is partly related to human economic well-being. Mm-hmm. To give you an example, in the Himalayas, I've done some work over there. There are areas, for example, inside the Mount Everest National Park, where the people live on a relatively subsistence level without running water and very little electricity and no roads in the area, so that they are cutting the forest when they're quite young to get fuel wood. Mm-hmm. And this, of course, doesn't leave the habitat of very large trees that certain species use. This same pattern went through New England about 200 years ago and was very common in much of Europe several hundred years ago, where large areas were deforested, mainly for fuel wood. And the result was that we suspect there were certain species that we lost, or there are certainly ones that were threatened. If you go to places like the tropics, many of our tropical forest areas that we assumed were always pristine, we're now beginning to suspect very strongly had been through times of intense agriculture, such as in the Mayan civilization, and it regrew. So the forest has a tremendous resiliency in a lot of places, but that doesn't mean that if we want to protect all species, we can say, well, anything goes, the forest will recover.
That was the next question. This is not a sign that everything's fine.
Well, what it is if we want to protect species and maintain all the species, don't want certain ones to go extinct, which I think is a very noble and I would personally agree with that position, then what we need to do is be sure that our human activities mimic natural disturbances and so that we allow all the different structures to be maintained over an area.
When you say structures, people won't necessarily know what you mean.
Okay. After, as I mentioned, after a large disturbance, you have an open area with very few, if any, large trees, mainly small trees or shrubs. That's what we call one structure. Mm-hmm. As the forest regrows, it grows to a very dense, closed forest where, interestingly enough, very few species can live.
Because?
Just because there is very few herbs and shrubs, so the species that need to browse from the ground level don't have anything to eat. The higher up in the canopy of the forest, there's relatively few insects, so you don't have many species living there. As the forest grows older, then you begin to have some of the trees dying, you get more sunlight on the forest floor, so you get more shrubs and herbs. You get some snags for insects, for woodpeckers, such animals as this. So when we refer to structure, we refer to the appearance and the species within the forest in the different conditions. Mm-hmm. Now, you see, if you had a large human disturbance over an area that created everything in that open structure all at once, and there weren't other areas elsewhere that had the closed forest, then the species that needed that closed forest would become very threatened. Mm-hmm. Similarly, if we all of a sudden stopped our harvesting or other management and the open areas all grew up the closed forest, unless there were natural disturbances that occurred at the right time, you would lose the species that use the open areas.
This is a red flagged term, and I don't mean it so. Is this an argument against what we think of as preservationist protection of forests?
Well, there's two things that I would be concerned about with the preservationists. You see, preservation isn't an objective. It's a means of achieving the objective.
Leave it alone.
Right. But the question is, will that achieve the objective? If the objective is to preserve all species, then if we try to preserve a certain area, we have the problem that we're recognizing our disturbances naturally covered very large areas, hundreds of thousands of acres, sometimes even more, so that if we preserve a relatively small area, a single disturbance can wipe out all of a certain structure in that area, and we haven't accomplished our objective of maintaining all species. The answer to that then is preserve a larger area and a larger area, and then you run into the NIMBY problem. If we're going to preserve this area and its resources, we have to get the resources from elsewhere, which means we're exporting our environmental problems.
And not only that, in this country at least, we have the complication of who owns what. There's privately owned land, publicly owned, public by the state, public by the federal government.
Right.
There's land that's already, quote, locked up, and land that's logged. And
right. Yeah, there's that, the diversity of who owns it. But even on our public lands, we need to look at the perspective of if we decide we want to preserve this area, what are the trade-offs in terms of what does that do to our use of resources elsewhere? Does it impact the globe elsewhere? Does it do more harm than good in certain places?
It seems to me that what you're talking about is both very optimistic and daunting. How do we manage for...
The how-to isn't very difficult. And let me go back a little bit. We keep talking about how-to or versus the objectives. And I'd like to discuss that just a minute, if we could.
Sure. What's wrong with putting how-to first?
Well, I'll give you an example. In the days when we thought that bad blood was what caused people to be sick, then you could imagine a scenario where people would get into a lot of objectives of, do we bleed people more or do we bleed people less? Rather than thinking now, putting leeches on people is simply a how-to. The overall objective is to make the person well. Mm-hmm. And maybe we were thinking in terms of the wrong paradigm when we were thinking bad blood made people sick. So instead of people thinking from the perspective of how do we operate on this person, let's think more from the perspective of how do we want to get this person well.
So one criticism of leeching is that not only was it the wrong thing to do, but it so narrowed the focus that we didn't see the whole.
Yes, right. Now, if we look at what the objective is of our environmental concerns, it's such things as maintaining local ecological stability and global ecological stability. And I think along with that, the same or different people also have human well-being. Now that gets into some type of a focus of what our objective is. Then we say, begin looking at the science and saying, what are the different ways of getting there? Mm-hmm. Preservation is one way. Some type of what we have done historically in many places, which is commodity extraction, is another way. Another way is trying to do what's been put in such terms as ecosystem management or landscape management or forest health management that I'll talk about in a minute.
Good.
But if each of these are things that we can then do some scientific analysis with, if we preserve an area, let's look at the historical range of disturbances, and is that likely to maintain our objectives? What does that do to maintaining the local ecological stability? And when I say stability, what I mean is, since nature was always dynamic and fluctuating, mm-hmm. but because it operated over large areas, it maintained structures for all species. Is a preservation going to be the best way to maintain all of these structures? The second thing is, what will preservation do to the global environment, and then what will it do to human well-being? Mm-hmm. Then we ask the question, how about commodity production management? What will that do to local ecological stability? Will that maintain all structures? What does that do to the global environment and to human well-being? And then the other one would be something like this landscape management, where what we do is we use our various silvicultural operations, harvesting, replanting, thinning, protecting from fires, such measures as that, to mimic, avoid, and recover from these natural disturbances so that we maintain all the structures across the landscape.
Do we know enough to do this?
Interestingly enough, we know quite a bit about how to mimic, avoid, and recover from these disturbances. Silvicultural practices have been, the knowledge behind them has been around for a very long time. We're learning more. Of course, we'll always need to learn more, but we know enough so that we could do quite a bit. The problems or the roadblocks have generally not been technical. They're as much economic and policy as anything else.
Dr. Chad Deering, that's his middle name, I'm sorry. Dr. Chadwick Deering Oliver is our guest today on Conversations. We're taking a look at managing forests and management of the forests under a new way of thinking. This is Conversations. A thought about some background on Dr. Oliver. He was almost literally raised in forestry, working with his hands for 8 years between 1960 and 1968 at his father's consulting and land managing company in Camden, South Carolina, where he was raised. He did that, as far as I can tell from the dates, that was through high school and your first 4 years of college, right?
Yes, yeah. During vacations in college.
And after that as a researcher before he began to teach, first at Harvard, and then and until now as a professor of silviculture and forest ecology at the University of Washington in Seattle. On Conversations today, Dr. Chad Oliver, our topic is managing forests. I'm very interested in those major roadblocks to what you call landscape management, that they're not, they don't have much to do with the dirt and the trees. They have a great deal to do with human beings.
They do. It's interesting. We know how to do these various operations, mimicking natural processes. But if we know that we want a certain structure in an area, say we have all young forests, and we need as quickly as possible to create some of the old growth forests so that species that are threatened there will be able to survive, we would need to thin some of the trees, leave some snags, create snags, create logs. Excuse me.
We thin trees to create room. We create snags to create
right.
New rotted...
Ride material for insects, woodpeckers, etc. Right. The question, we know how to do it. The question is, who is going to pay for it? Huh. Now, you see, most of our forest management to date on public and private lands has been paid for by people extracting the wood.
Loggers.
Mm-hmm. We have many forests, some of them in Alaska, for example, and in the inland west, and other areas that are very dense. The trees are very close together. As such, they are getting insects in them, and these insects are killing the trees and will get very catastrophic fires. It would be similar to some of what's happening on the Kenai Peninsula right mm-hmm. now. Now, what we could do technically is go in and remove some of the trees. Now, what that will do is allow the other trees more room to grow, which means they'll be more vigorous, less susceptible to insects, and less susceptible to fires. We know this. I could give you an example of a fire that burned 250,000 acres but avoided an area where the forest had been thinned.
Because?
Because the trees were healthier, they didn't have as much dead material in them.
So they didn't ignite as fast, didn't burn?
Yeah, they didn't burn. Uh-huh. The fire just went around them.
And there wasn't as much to burn whatever started
right.
to burn.
Right.
Yes, all right.
Now, don't get me wrong, we would want some areas with these insects because there are certain species that prey on the insects. But we wouldn't want a whole landscape of hundreds of thousands of acres with these insects.
And we also want fire, too,
oh, yes.
don't we?
Oh, yes.
We think we don't, because
right.
fire feels so destructive. But quickly, because it seems to me some of Alaska's forests depend
right.
on fire, explain why fire is sometimes a good thing.
Well, fire is good in that it helps recycle nutrients. It creates some of these open conditions that certain species need. It promotes certain species. The question is, rather than having it occur at a time that we are unplanned and over a scale that we can't control, if we could control the time and place so that we can anticipate it, then we will be much better off in terms of protecting our other values.
Could we as human beings have avoided the Yosemite fire and avoided
oh, yes.
the Sydney fire?
Oh, yes. Hmm. We could have. But again, you see, such things as doing these thinnings are a cost. We know how to do it, but we don't have a institutional mechanism of paying to do something that will avoid these fires.
Okay. Then do we need next to talk about money and
we
where
could.
It comes from?
We could.
Okay. Loggers have the greatest commercial interest in a forest. Is that true?
I'd have to think about that, but go ahead.
Okay. Well, I was thinking that if we start with those who have the greatest financial investment and financial desire
mm-hmm.
from that forest as a commodity, then we'd begin with them as the first line of people who might bear the expense?
Well, loggers have an interest in certain forests or certain trees in a forest. There are certain forested areas that you could give to a logger and they would walk away from it. Either the trees are too small mm-hmm. or the trees are too far from a road, or the only way they could harvest it would be two practices that we may not want. They may go in and just take the biggest trees and leave everything else, which may not be what we want, or they may decide to go in and take everything, which may not be what we want. So they have, what happens is their extraction of timber can be one of the most capital intensive parts of forest management. But if you look at what's happening around Los Angeles now, where there were these fires after which there were floods and soil slumps, and now we're finding more rains and more soil slumps, there the local people who are having their houses burned up and the soil slumped also have a very high financial interest in the forest and its condition.
Mm-hmm.
But what's happened is we need to find a way to manage or to fund managing the forest so that we keep a balance of structures even when it's not economically, even when it cannot be paid for by the extraction of timber.
Okay. Then who's the logical manager?
Well, the manager can be the same people, the forest who have managed it before. It's just that you need to take away from them the constraint of saying that you can't do anything unless removal of wood will pay for it.
I see.
And the second thing is you need to have the give them the objective of maintaining all structures rather than having the objective of get as much wood out or wood of a certain quality out or making the greatest financial return from wood as possible.
This takes us briefly away from the issue of money, but how amenable is our forestry departments and divisions at the state and federal government level to managing in this broad way?
Well, like every group, they have some people in it have a certain mindset of we will manage this way, and that needs to be changed. I deal mainly in a lot of my mid-career courses with the people from recently out of school up to about mid-career level. These are the people that are on the ground who see some of the frustrating effects of harvesting too much on an area
mm-hmm.
or of not being able to thin an area and so watching the insects eat it up and then watching it burn. These people, when I teach this perspective in short courses, get excited about it. They say, we know we can do it. This is why we went into forestry.
Mm-hmm.
This is what we want to do. We would need to find ways of first getting the public to accept that we will do this active management to maintain these structures. Secondly, finding ways to fund this type of management. Now,
okay.
Extraction of wood can help, but in places where extraction of wood wouldn't pay for the total amount of it, then we need to add money so that the extraction of wood would help otherwise, or not extracting wood.
Okay. Back to money. How are we going to? How do you suggest that happen?
Now that's an interesting issue, and there's several ways to do it. I was going to say the third thing we need is policy changes, and that gets into the wood, into the money issue.
Okay.
Very often now we either have money channeled because of policies to certain activities but not others. We have a lot of money that we're willing to put into fighting fires and recovering from fires. But if we instead were able to put this money into avoiding the fires, then it would probably be cheaper. We have a lot of money to put into unemployment, but if we were to use this money to help pay for the active management of these areas through such things as thinning, we would be able to do these activities, employ the people as well. So there's a number of different policies that basically need to be reconciled. There are also other ways that we could raise money for these, and what you have to look at is if the public wants these stable or this balance of structures across a landscape, it's a public value that we need to find a way for the public to provide it. One, historically what we've done is we've tried to just regulate it, make people do these.
Mm-hmm.
But as we can talk about in a few minutes, the regulations won't be as effective as giving people the incentives so that they'll want to do them. Funding for these incentives could go through such things, as I mentioned, of revamping our unemployment perspective so that it becomes more an active work. The money is going into finding ways for these people to do productive work.
Mm-hmm.
Another one would be to find money out of various taxes. And working with Dr. Lipke, professor in forest economics and director of our Center for International Trade of Forest Products at the University of Washington. One of the suggestions that he's made that I like is looking at a carbon sequestration tax. That is that our utilities and everything else are using fossil fuels to produce electricity. And one possibility would be that if we look at this production of CO2 as being something undesirable, there have been various suggestions of how do we re-sequester carbon dioxide take it out of the atmosphere. And one of the main ways to do this is through forests. As they grow, they fix the carbon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as they burn up, of course, they release it again. But if you put efforts into putting the carbon back into the trees and then use the wood products as when you harvest them to create the different structures as a substitute for steel, aluminum, brick, or concrete, then you end up with an incredible savings of CO2 from going into the atmosphere, mainly because utilizing wood as a substitute for these other products produces far less carbon dioxide than trying to produce similar products out of steel, aluminum, brick, concrete.
Because it takes so much of the fossil fuel product to create steel, aluminum,
yes.
et cetera.
Yes, to basically mine it, refine it, transport it,
sure.
And put it up.
This is interesting because it kind of flies in the face of what we think of as progress. Wood is old-fashioned. Our ancestors used wood. We are modern. We use aluminum.
Mm.
So there are some mental sets that have to be either maneuvered around or reconstructed for us to
right.
And follow you here.
Well, just like we need to change from the concept of a forest as a steady state to constant change, wood can be an extremely efficient and valuable product. We use an awful lot of it in this country, but we could put efforts into finding new ways of using it. You talk to people, engineers, and structurally it's something very beautiful. We're developing ways now where we can impregnate it with ceramics to make it stiffer. We can glue it together different ways to make longer structures. I think that if we changed our mindset to thinking of wood as a potentially very valuable modern product, it could have tremendous uses, not just the traditional ones, but a greater variety. And then incidentally, the more you had a value to wood for these different products, then the more economical, the less costly it would be to do these different manipulations to the forest to create the structures we desired.
Okay. Now let me think what we've left behind in the last few minutes. One was, I think, an important... if I can find the word here. One was, I think, the important issue of whether to regulate or to give incentives to ask that people change their ways. Mm. Why doesn't regulation work in your mind?
Well, first of all, you have to realize that a forest area is extremely large, and it's very difficult to police a forest area. So trying to impose any type of management or any type of activities on a forest area that the local people don't agree with generally isn't very successful. If you look in the history of the world, the local people will work counter to it unless they are in agreement with it. Mm-hmm. Now, what regulations do is they try to make the owner or the local people do things that they're not already doing. And the reason they're not already doing it is because they it's usually not within their best economic interest. They don't perceive it to be. So you're asking them to put more effort or more cost into the forest.
Or stop doing something that would bring them profit.
Yes,
that
right.
They would rather not stop doing.
Right. Now, theoretically, what a regulation like that would do is it would mean that, well, in order to do this extra, anything like a harvest of timber would mean that the timber would cost more, and the public would pay for that extra cost, and therefore the cost of the regulation would be carried over to the general public. Mm-hmm. That would work well if we could impose these regulations throughout the world, and if we could impose it on all substitute products like steel, aluminum, brick. But what we find is if we impose regulations in one area, which raise the cost here of doing things, then people basically don't invest as much, and we just begin harvesting more timber elsewhere or using more substitute products, which, as we've said, are more polluting. Now,
which is bad for the economy, bad for the ecology, bad
right.
for the local community.
Right,
right.
Exactly.
Okay.
And it usually doesn't get the regulations done, because the other thing about regulations is that they are generally designed so that people try to hide what they're doing. Now, if you could turn that around to incentives so that a person was rewarded for doing something that the public had value in, then that would make the person want to do them. You would get less hiding. You would get a better idea of what of how much of these is occurring. The local people would be given a personal value for providing a public value. See, what you have is, by regulations, you're asking a local person, landowner, group, whatever, to provide a public value at their expense. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, this country works on a free market system for good reasons. We found that to be the most efficient. What you would want is for a public value to be paid for by the public so that the landowner gets rewarded for it. I'll give you a good example of that. In the state of Washington, if a person has a spotted owl in their forest, they can't harvest the trees because it's protected. Now, since a spotted owl is endangered because there aren't enough of the forest, of the structure of the spotted owl, you would think that we would want everyone to grow as much of that particular structure as possible.
That's been our logic.
That's what been, well, except let's look at it this way. if you own a forest that wasn't in the structure of the spotted owl, and you could harvest it, but if it grew to the structure of the spotted owl, then you couldn't harvest it, what would you do?
I cut my forest.
That's exactly what's happening to the small private landowners in Washington. Rather than them thinning their forest to create the structure for the spotted owl, the regulations that say if you have a spotted owl, you can't cut your forest, they are harvesting their forest, clear-cutting it before it gets to that structure to avoid the what they perceive as a problem. We could probably maintain and create a lot more spotted owl structure if we rewarded the private landowner through an incentive by saying, if you have a spotted owl, we will reward you this much more.
And still allow you to do what you need to do to make a living?
What we could do is, yes, exactly. Uh-huh. See, the type of thing we could do is we could give a certain amount of money to anyone who had a spotted owl on their land, and then also guarantee that at a certain time the government would either pay for the loss in income from that land through some type of a bonding system or a contract, or allow them to harvest it. What you would do is you would be creating so much more spotted owl habitat that the hope would be the spotted owl would no longer be endangered. Oh. I can give you an example that I've heard about. I can't substantiate it, but apparently in Montana, where the ranchers have always fought against the wolves, some of the environmental groups, I believe, have developed a system whereby the rancher is not only given a certain amount of money if he has a wolf pack on his land, but any of the animals that the wolves kill, any of his cattle, the rancher is then compensated for. He's providing the public value of the wolves, and he's not losing money on it. And so consequently, instead of them trying to get rid of wolves, hide what they're doing, there's an encouragement to produce the wolves there.
The wolf or the spotted owl or whatever this beast or species of plant would be is then becoming part of the private owner's interest.
Yes,
I look
exactly.
after my wolves the same way as I look after my cattle.
Exactly.
Chad Oliver is with us on Conversations today. He's worked as a Fulbright lecturer in Turkey and Germany and made an extended research trek to Nepal to determine the impact of grazing and other disturbances on forest development. That trek was part of his background work for the planning of an extension of the Mount Everest National Park. On this edition, we're talking about different ways, very different ways actually, of looking at forestry and ways that human beings can mimic the natural disturbances of nature in order to create the most biodiverse and useful forests. We have about 10 minutes left, and I think I'd like to devote this time, if you think it's a good use of our time, to the ways that public and private interests can learn to work together. What you've raised as an example in Montana seems to be somewhat of an anomaly. In so many places, the environmentalists, the biologists, the foresters, the loggers, the representatives of government and the communities are all on opposite sides, if that's possible. It's a very embattled situation. If we can take, say, the interior of Alaska forest, which is not yet logged and which is potentially going to be of commercial interest to the area, how would you talk to this community about ways to get along, as Rodney King says, and ways to manage the forest for the health of the forest and the health of the community? That's a huge question, but we can break it down however you'd like.
Okay. Well, first of all, something that the group up here seems to be doing is they're first focusing on objectives rather than focusing on how do we get there, how do we manage. And they first say, what are our objectives?
And you say that's good.
That's good.
Yeah.
And if they start with general objectives and then begin breaking them up into specific objectives, that's very good. That's in keeping with many of the modern decision-making processes, that such things as The National Environmental Policy Act advocates or recommends.
A quick look at general objectives and specific ones?
Then kind of refining those general ones into specific ones. From the general idea of do good to then, say, local economic stability, local ecological stability. Then economic stability may mean employment as well as a healthy environment, etc. Then you break those up. And then you begin looking at alternative ways of achieving those. And you may look at such things as preservation, various types of development, and from straight commodity production to some type of balanced production. And you can look at, and you can, with the help of experts and analysis, you can actually do a objective calculation of how will this activity impact employment, how will it impact the local environment, how will it impact species, mm-hmm. etc. So you can come up with a quite objective analysis there. Then you need to have the local people on all levels decide, given an array of alternatives, and each one will achieve some of the objectives to different extents, which ones of these are preferable. Now, this gets to another very interesting paradigm we're going through right now, and that is the change from the organizational structure of some type of a central decision-making body and central planning down to where the local people more take orders, to a decision-making structure where you enfranchise the local people and that they understand the decisions, they take part in them, and they participate in the solution of it.
Centralized decision-making has always been very suspicious of bottoms-up decision-making.
It has been, and we're seeing that the modern management concepts, the ones that that were made very famous in Japan and now are being adapted by various companies in the United States, do have this enfranchising the local people. You need an organizational structure to decide what your overall objectives are, but the specifics of how to get there are made at as local a level as possible. Mm-hmm. For good reason, and especially in things like forest management, the decision of should we allow a fire in an area? Well, that depends very specifically on a given area. If the forest is about to burn anyway, and it looks like it'll burn over a large area, you may want to divide it up and burn a certain area when you can control it. Or if you have an area that has all closed forest and a species is about to go extinct because you don't have enough openings, there may be the decision to help the species diversity would be to clear cut. On the other hand, if everything was clear cut but one patch in an area, mm-hmm. the decision to make a clear cut may be the worst for biodiversity. So you need to have the decisions made at the local level, which means the local people need to be enfranchised and using their creativity. I heard a talk by Khrushchev's son about 2 or 3 years ago, and he said that his father, Nikita Khrushchev, got disenfranchised with the communist system when he realized that central planning doesn't work, mm-hmm. that one person can only keep a certain number of things in their brain, and if they try to make all the decisions will be so inefficient that the lower people in the organizational structure will be using their creativity to get around an inefficient system. And the secret is to use everybody's creativity to work toward us and the same overall objective. Unfortunately, in natural resource management, we've tended to have quite a bit of central planning. We've either decided fire was good, fire was bad, clear-cutting was good, clear-cutting was bad. That issue has gone back and forth 5 or 6 times. The result being that the forests that benefited from clear-cutting were helped while those that were harmed by it were hurt. And then when we switched to no clear cutting, we hurt some forests and helped others.
Which goes back to your thesis that by managing for acts, for physical acts, we err, and we should be managing by objective.
Right.
Is there any point where silviculture, tinkering with nature, mimicking nature, is something you think we should not do?
Oh, yes. This place is where the forest, we probably shouldn't be tinkering with it. One place would be where if we have an old growth area and there is too little old growth within this landscape, rather than going in and trying to do something to that old growth, the best, probably, if our objective is this biodiversity, the silviculture should mainly be looked at ways of trying to protect that.
Mm-hmm.
In other areas where if the public, if we have an area we know very little about and it's very unique and sensitive, and we're not concerned that immediately a disturbance will disturb it in a way we don't want it to be, that may be an area we want to avoid for the time being, where there's no economic way of entering an area, then it's a public decision. Do we want to invest money in doing something or let it go its natural condition? And then the silviculturist probably shouldn't be there.
This is a very active, human-involved nature and human literally holding hands.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
You have to realize that whenever we look at what should be done to a given forest or a given landscape, we always consider the no-action alternative,
mm-hmm.
not just continue the present, but what happens if we stopped everything? And when, as I mentioned, when we list our objectives and our array of alternatives, the general decision-making process is always one of them being the do-nothing alternative,
in
just
there.
To see will that get us more.
Thanks for a very interesting hour, Chad Oliver. I think you must think you work in a fascinating field.
I thoroughly enjoy it.
Yes.
You've
made it enjoyable and clear in the last hour. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Chadwick Deering Oliver has been our guest for the last hour on Conversations, a PhD from Yale, a full professor of silviculture and forest ecology at the University of Washington in Seattle since 1986. He has spent a good deal, it seems, of the summer and fall of 1993 before the House and Senate testifying on forest ecosystems management, and also travels and writes a good deal talking about how silviculture can make forests as healthy as possible. I want to thank you for a very interesting hour once again.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Good. I'm Susan McGinnis. This has been Conversations. I hope you join me again next week.